Auburn Scepter by Sir William Walton. Sir Adrian Bolt was conducting the London Philharmonic Orchestra, and that recording has just been reissued. And so this edition of Sunday Morning draws to a close. I do hope you found it as interesting to listen to as I did to compile it, and I thank you for staying tuned. Next week, our cantata is by Telemann, Kings and Queens. Provide my theme from 10 until 11, and my concerto for orchestra is by Zoltán Kodály's great friend and compatriot, Béla Bartók. So please do join me same time next Sunday, 9 o'clock.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
On Radio 3, Opera on 3. Angela Georgiou in a work she has long championed. Puccini's La Rondinée at the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden.
You'll see, I will dance, I will sing. There are waltzes, but there are also a tragedy. It's a sort of La Traviata, you'll see. And it's sad, but I'm not dying. That's so good.
Tomorrow night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, now it's midday and time for Private Passions. As part of our Sound of Cinema season, Michael Barclay's guest today is the film director, Beban Kidron.
Beban Kidron is a rare and unpredictable filmmaker. In A Predominantly Man's World, she's made highly successful dramas such as the BAFTA-winning Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit and the blockbusting rom-com Bridget Jones' The Edge of Reason, but she also makes documentaries which come straight from her heart, films about sex workers in New York, the women of Greenham Common, the sculptor Anthony Gormley, and a highly acclaimed film about girls sold into religious prostitution in India. And her latest film, In Real Life, is a documentary about teenagers and the internet. So in some ways, it's quite hard to pigeonhole you, but maybe that's a good thing. I mean, do you feel that there's one central theme or idea that dominates the things that you do and want to do?
I think that I've always been really interested in people who don't have a voice or feel that they don't have a voice, about representing those parts of the world that perhaps a bit uncomfortable to look at. And it's harder to see in some of the big blockbusters, as you say, but, you know, I remember going to Hollywood for the first time, and the film I made was actually the first mainstream Hollywood film about gay people in which no one had an illness, you know. So it's sort of trying to sort of remind us that there is more than meets the eye and that we don't have to always go to the surface of things.
Do the documentaries act as a kind of grounding? You know, that there, you have to get down and dirty in the gutter slightly compared to a feature film.
Well, they do. It's a funny thing, the documentaries. I don't think I choose them so much as they choose me. I often find that I am making a documentary rather than that I decided to make a documentary. And the film that you refer to, the one where I went to India, I was really bag-packed and bought a ticket to India before I had consciously thought, I am making a film about this. But I'd heard something on the radio about these young girls who were going to be, who were chosen by their parents and given to God. And then when they reached maturity, they were going to be sent into prostitution. And I thought, no, not in the name of God. You can't do this to young girls. And I was sort of on my way to India to find them before I'd even quite thought about it. So I suppose it does keep you sane, and it does absolutely take you to places in the world that you wouldn't go in a normal life. And it absolutely is an antidote to some of the sillier bits of Hollywood. But I think that it is just a passion to try and tell stories that has always just followed me for 30 years.
How important as a filmmaker and in telling these stories is music for you?
Oh, I was worried about that question coming. I often say, no music, no music. We're not allowed any music in this documentary. It's going to make it too easy to not confront the issue. So I think that I feel like a double-headed monster on this subject, in that where music is beautifully put and sensitively made and part of the offer of the film, it is, of course, you know, a great thing. But where music is used to excuse the things we've messed up in the making.
Paper over the cracks.
Paper over the cracks. Or mediate someone's feelings. Bully them. Bully them into feeling something when they don't feel it already. You know, so I think that's a real problem in film. And I think that there are fashions and moments, and we have to guard against it so that those film scores that really deliver are the ones that are a part of the conversation of the film and not something that's shoring it up.
It sounds from what you're saying, so music might be more important in the fantasy world of feature films, where we're being asked to suspend belief, whereas in documentaries you're asking people to deal with reality.
I think that's true, and I often in the documentaries use music tracks or found music from the situation and try and represent how music is used by the people in the film. So in real life, I use the anthems of that age group rather than my taste in music or my choice of music. Try and do things that represent the feelings that come from within. And you're right, in the sort of creation of a world, then music plays a big part.
Well, this is a very good example, isn't it? Because it immediately suggests an ominous presence.
Well, it's the theme music from Jaws. And I think that what I love about it is that actually, you know, there's these two notes. I mean, how simple is that? And apparently when Spielberg first listened to it, he thought John Williams was having him on. He thought it was a joke. John Williams said, no, 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 listen to this. And I think the thing that I admire so much in this score as a whole is that John Williams plays with three things. He plays with silence, he plays with humour, and then he plays with tension. And he uses all three of those elements at different times to create tension. So sometimes when you're following the shark and this rather joyous, funny, kind of tongue-in-cheek music is happening, and you're going, I know those two notes are going to start. I know they're coming. I know they're coming. But somehow he always takes you by surprise when they actually come.
The opening from the soundtrack to Steven Spielberg's 1975 film Jaws, composed, of course, by John Williams. Actually, two things occur to me, Beavan, listening to that. One is the wonderful use of space. And so that sound of the kind of rigging just, you know, making a clattering noise is almost as frightening as anything else, because suddenly you're cast adrift from the sound you'd been listening to. But the other thing is that when allied to a visual image, audiences can take in music which they would often find quite challenging in the concert hall.
It's interesting you say that, because I was thinking about film music and about why it's different. And I think it is because it's only one element of these three things that are going on, one being the picture, the music, the other the music, obviously. And then there is the sound of the film itself. And I do think that that is what marks a great film composer, as opposed to a great composer or great music, is that they take on board all of those things. And you're absolutely right. I mean, I don't know if you know the film, but there's this sort of remarkable moment where the first young woman is killed and the music leaves so rapidly and all you can hear is the sea, but the sea is very calm. And so it's almost the silence of the sea that you can hear, if you understand what I mean. And it's a remarkable moment. And I do actually remember hearing that in the theatre, in the movie theatre, you know, that silence and the horror that was sort of embedded in that moment. And it was all about what was not there. And I think that is actually a quality that will come up a couple of times in our conversation, because all good film composers have it.
Your great breakthrough came with Oranges, Not the Only Fruit, a wonderful book. Tell me about the music in that film.
Well, you know, Oranges was made at a sort of at the end of a rather wonderful time in the BBC, where there was sort of extraordinary drama going on. And, you know, it was the era of Dennis Potter and Alan Clark. And, you know, it was a fantastic time to be there. Now, I think that Jeanette Winterson, I and Philippa Giles, who made Oranges, were sort of really the new girls on the block. I mean, not only were there not many girls on the block, but actually it was a very, very small project, and the BBC sort of didn't quite understand what they'd let themselves in for. So it seemed really important to us that we get a female composer. And someone had told us about Rachel Portman, and we had very, very little money to make that programme. We had got to the end of the process. We had no money for the score. I mean, it was absolutely ludicrous. I think we had four or five musicians. And we went to Rachel and said, you know, we want something that is so distinctive, something that absolutely, if you hear it without the picture, you will understand that you are in the world of Oranges.
Well, the interesting thing is that actually music is always just about the last thing that goes on to a film, isn't it?
It is, and that's why it often gets the job of rescuing what has failed before and sometimes enhancing, you know, the strong bits. And actually that's another great skill of the movie composer, is actually not to make more muscular that that works and not rescue that that doesn't. I mean, they have a balancing act, you know, that is actually about making something holistic and good out of what you've done. Now, Rachel's a very wonderful composer, and I did four films with her ultimately. But one of the things that I think is, it's definitely not unique, but it's quite unusual, especially now, is that she composes on the piano in a very, very quiet room. And when you go to hear the music for the first time, obviously you can hear the rhythm and you can hear the tune, as it were, the melody. But what you can't hear is the instrumentation. And I was very aware, watching her face, that she was hearing something different to what I was hearing. And I think that that was something that was absolutely sort of entrancing for me as a relatively young director, working with a composer only for the second time. And I would see her face transported, and somehow I could tell through her annoyance with herself and her joy and her transportation, whether it was working or not, even more than my own reaction to it.
The main theme from Rachel Portman's soundtrack to the 1990 BBC adaptation of Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. I once had to write music in the style of John Barry for a documentary which was called Goldeneye, actually, but before the big film. And it was a documentary about Ian Fleming, with Charles Dance as Fleming. And I never had more fun in my life because I love what he does. But you've worked with him, haven't you?
I have, and it's funny because I was trying to think this morning on my way here, you know, how did I ever get John Barry to do my score? I mean, he was a legend by the time I came along, and but for whatever reason, he agreed, and I was absolutely, you know, I was excited.
This was Amy Foster, your film, wasn't it?
It was Amy Foster. I think it eventually went out into the cinemas and under the title Swept from the Sea. But it was an adaptation of a Joseph Conrad short story, and John had agreed. Now, John was a very serious character about his music. He did not phone it in. There was nothing about John that phoned in his music. And in fact, he chose, and remember, he lived in America, he chose to come to Port Isaac, where we were shooting the film, just to kind of get the sniff of what we were doing, to get a sense of the actors, to know how it was I worked.
In Cornwall.
In Cornwall, yeah. So there we were filming, and in fact, as it happened, I was 7 months pregnant at the time. So we were filming in the mud, we were by the sea. You know, it was very tiring. You do 18-hour days, you know, I was big as a house. And he looked at me in the middle of this scene, and he came up to me and he tapped me on the shoulder, and I thought he was going to say something to me very, you know, critical about the film, and I was quite anxious because he was this great man. And he said, "You don't have the right boots." I said, what do you mean? He said, "You need much better boots to be working out in this weather." Well, anyway, he came and we talked about the music and we had a really, really wonderful couple of days. But the day after he left, a big box arrived. And actually, I feel quite emotional saying it, but, you know, out of it came my boots, which I did, in fact, wear for the rest of the film. And my 16-year-old daughter, who is the baby that I was carrying at the time, now has those boots and wears those boots.
Sea of Death, from John Barry's soundtrack to the 1997 film Amy Foster, or Sweat from the Sea, directed by my guest today, Beban Kidron. Curiously, I don't know, and we haven't told the audience what the composer was actually describing there, so unless people have seen the film, they wouldn't know. But So if we're going to now run this backwards, as it were, it occurred to me that that was quite emotional music, that it could have shots with the sea involved, and that something rather turbulent was either happening or about to happen. Now you tell us.
Well, you're very kind not to tell the audience that I'm sitting here in tears, actually. I was just remembering the moment of recording it, actually, and we were with the London Philharmonic in Abbey Road with John Barry, you know, and the pictures come up on the screen, and in fact what it is there's been a shipwreck and all the bodies have come up on the beach. And Ian McKellen plays a doctor in the film, and he is looking for one live soul. And of course there are none. And he is rushing around the beach looking for anybody who's alive when an old woman, played by Marjorie Withers, comes down and says, "Is it one of ours? Is it one of ours?" And of course she's from a community of fishermen, and for her, you know, they used to live in perpetual fear of the ship that goes down. And she praises God when she finds out it's not one of theirs. And everybody around sort of hushes her and quiets her, because you cannot praise God that it's not one of yours, because it was somebody else's. And this whole idea of sort of, you know, economic migration and the problem of the sea and our relationship to nature and the horror of not finding anyone alive is all there in John's music. I mean, it's so rich and so present, and he doesn't overwhelm.
No, but the scoring there is very telling. That the bass sound is absolutely wonderful. I was just listening to what he was doing and admiring it. It is extraordinary how music can, in fact, manipulate the viewer, isn't it? I mean, if you see a woman going up a hill to a lonely church, the music will probably tell you whether she's going to meet her lover or going to be murdered.
Exactly. As we found out from John Williams, all you need is two notes to know that you're going to be murdered.
Actually, I think it's one note, isn't it? Really repeated. What music surrounded you in your childhood, Beban?
Well, it's interesting because we're about to play one, a piece. I mean, my father was a sort of a curious character. And all through my childhood, I remember him playing Radio 3, you know, endlessly as he worked in his study. And I feel as an adult slightly upset that he didn't really pass that on fully to us, his own children. He didn't really sort of sit us on the knee and say, you know, have you heard this? Do you understand that? Shall we take you here? So it was a sort of almost like another world, the world from which he came.
He was a very creative figure.
Yeah, he was. He was a very big political figure. He was a very radical lefty, and he was a writer and a publisher, Michael Kidron, my father. But what he did bequeath us was something more popular and absolutely, you know, heartfelt, I think, which is that whenever we went on a long car journey, he would do the full gamut of protest songs and spirituals and, you know, the Internationale in every possible language. And he had a fantastic voice. And in fact, my sister has a fantastic voice. And I have a voice that you can only use in the shower when no one's listening. But he did bequeath us these fantastic songs.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, Now it's done, brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done, brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodle down. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember, they call me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember, I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, ah, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember, they call me Al. It was Al all the time. Hey, don't you remember? I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare a dime?
Al Jolson singing Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? And by the way, details of all Beeb and Kidron's choices are available on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. You can also discover how to download the programme. Your next choice of music, Beeben, has strong resonances, I think, for you and indeed your family's history.
Mm. Yes, I mean, I was introduced to opera very late in my life, and I have since grown to enjoy it hugely. And when we heard that The Passenger was coming to the ENO, we were very excited because it had been banned for so long, and it had been such a important project to get this to the stage, you know. And it dealt with a story between two women, one of whom had been a guard at a concentration camp during the war, and one of whom had been her prisoner.
A bit like The Reader, in some ways.
Yeah, indeed, very like The Reader. Now, my mother's family, many of them were in concentration camps. Many of them lost their lives there. And it's not hugely spoken about in the family. There was a sort of a sense of that those who survived were very hushed about it, about what had happened. It was almost like they wanted it to be quiet so that no one, you know, would see them. It was almost that invisibility that they craved. But somehow the thought of this opera was very exciting. When it came to the day of seeing it, unfortunately, my husband Lee was working, caught up in rehearsal, and he wasn't able to make it. And I had this terribly expensive ticket to the opera. And I went to the ENO and I tried to give the ticket away. And it was one of my sort of very saddest cultural experiences, that every time I went to someone in the queue and said, do you want a ticket to the opera? And they'd look at my ticket and they'd see it was a very expensive ticket. And they say, how much do you want for it? And I'd say, nothing. And they thought there was something wrong with it. And in the end, I went into that room feeling rather cross, you know, rather cross with the world. I sat there and, you know, and again, you know, as the brilliance of art and its ability to transform situations, that when I laid my eyes on that set, which, you know, we often say in theatre that if it's a bad piece of work, you talk about the set. Well, in this instance, I'm afraid, you know, the set was part of the brilliance of the offer, because it really talked about, if we forget, yes, we will crumble under the effort of forgetting. And underneath there is always the truth. And the set and the opera dealt with that reality.
Tell us what we're going to hear, because in fact, I don't think it was recorded with an orchestra. So we're going to hear an excerpt sung by Susan Young during a discussion preceding the ENO premiere.
Yes, I find this really interesting, that an opera that struggled so much to get on the stage, you know, finally comes to being. And then when I actually chose it, we realised that there was no recording freely available, you know, for people to buy. And I'm really pleased that people can go to the English National Opera website and hear this. And they can hear the director talking about the journey, talking in great detail about what it meant to him to put this on stage, the whole history of this piece of work. And this is probably not really the best representation of the art itself, but it certainly was a fantastic evening.
This is Martyr's aria from Act Two of The Passenger by Weinberg.
An autumn come in peace, humbly and upon a silent wing. May the songbird celebrate my release, lonely bird left over from the spring. In the amber halo of the dawn, like that little bird, singing in the twilight one last time. Notes that soar, notes that soar up into sky.
That was Martyr's aria from Act Two of The Passenger, the opera by Mieczysław Weinberg. We heard Susan Young, accompanied on the piano there by Sonia Ben Santa Maria. I rather suspect that you quite like emotional intensity at the heart of your musical experiences, and perhaps most experiences.
Yes, you're right. And the piece of music that we're going to hear, I chose with such trepidation because, you know, Wagner is so wholly owned by those who love, who know, who are absorbed and informed about his work. But I went to see Tristan and Isolde, you know, at a time in my life that it was very difficult. You know, it was a difficult time, difficult week, difficult day. And there I was, you know, listening to this piece of music, and what I admired so much was that it demanded attention. You know, absolutely not a passive experience. It asked you to give something up of yourself, and it was a difficult time, and I felt like in real time, listening to the piece that we're going to hear, that I learnt something about the sacrificial nature of love. That's quite a hard thing to learn when you're well into your 40s. And I think it is a remarkable piece of work. And I think possibly the piece of music that, you know, in the hearing of it, has sort of transformed my feeling more than any other in that exact moment.
That's rather interesting because it takes us beyond simply saying that musical experiences like this are cathartic. but that they actually require your input and then inform you about yourself as a person as a result?
I think at the very edges of it, at the very... If it hits you at the right time, if you're open for change, it can be a catalyst for change. And I think that's something I believe, you know, of art. That's what I think it offers us, you know, that you stand in front of a painting and you see something differently, that you come out of a film and you've understood the world from a new perspective, and that you can listen to a piece of music and have reordered your emotional feeling. I mean, what an immense privilege to come across anything in art that does that for you.
The Liebestod from Act 3 of Wagner's Tristan and Isolde. We heard Birgit Nielsen with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by George Scholte. It is an extraordinary kind of moment of summation and transcendence, isn't it?
I really feel so. I mean, it, you know, the glory of love, the pain of love, the complexity of love, all of that sort of swirls about. You know, it has such a lot of motion and emotion in it.
Is it in that score and in great films, do you think, the fact that somebody else understands what you're feeling, as it were, that makes it so powerful?
I think that is part of it, sort of recognising and being recognised. I think human beings have a great need to be witnessed, and that there are very few places that we truly feel understood, and these stories help us. You know, I think also maybe it's the immersive quality of some of these experiences. And music obviously has a grand head start with that. Great capacity to allow us to be blocked out from everything else and have a singular experience. And I think really that, I think summation, that was the word you used, that is why that piece of music is so fantastic, is because all that has gone before it is pretty marvellous, but it somehow manages to round it up in this extraordinary fashion and simple.
You have been very passionate to share your enthusiasm for film and the medium of film with children who mightn't otherwise access it, and in particular as the founder of the Film Club. Just tell us a little how that works.
Well, what we do is we run film clubs in state schools, and it's a very simple idea. We show a film once a week during term time, and people sign up, they come and they see the film, and then they discuss it and they review it on our website. So it's a really, really simple idea, but it has a very powerful effect. And the reason it has a powerful effect is because, A, the films that we choose and the films that we help the kids choose are old films, classic films. They're films from all over the world. They show experiences that they wouldn't normally have access to. They're in many languages. And they are very, very sort of exciting for the kids. And the other bit is the club. It's a place where children come together. They come together with a teacher or a film club leader, and they feel part of something, and they feel that, you know, you don't have to be swift of mind or swift of foot to watch a film, but together they learn to have a voice. Now, as we've grown and as we become a much more sort of almost glamorous organisation, we do all sorts of things, like train kids to make films, and we send composers in, film composers in, to help them understand the point of music in film, and writers and editors and so on. It's sort of developed into a place where children can find a much wider world than the one they live in at home and at school, and a place where they see people who are passionate about making things and passionate about their work and passionate about things in the world that are bigger than them. And I think it's a great source of pride to me and to all of us at Film Club that children have come to it in such great numbers. I mean, we have 250,000 children every week who come to Film Club.
And, for example, in real life, your latest film, there's the concerns about the effects that the internet might be having on teenagers, which is a sort of perfect subject for that.
Yes, I mean, I was very, very sort of concerned at all the kids around me. I'm looking at them and they've all got a phone in their hand. And gradually, over a couple of years, you sort of watch them kind of addicted to these devices. And as they get addicted, they stop talking first to you and then to each other. And, you know, and then I just felt, I mean, I am very pro the internet. I've been in the communications business all my adult life, you know. And if the promise of the internet is that it's going to be democratic and open and free and a sort of a non-hierarchical space in which we can all speak to each other, then I am absolutely for it. But I began to notice things that were happening to young people that disturbed me. And the film that I've made is quite a challenging film. And I have started to show it now, and people are, in fact, responding and feeling quite powerfully moved by some of the issues in it. And I think we have a responsibility. We have decided as a society that until you're 18, that we have a sort of a duty of care. And I think we are not operating sufficiently in that mode right now.
I was very intrigued to see, Beban Kidron, when I saw your list of music, that you've got the music that was used in a film, which I found very intriguing, The Beat That My Heart Skipped, which is about a hoodlum who wants to be a pianist. Why did you decide to include this as your final choice?
Well, I did love the film when I saw it, and it's amongst many, many very good films that come out of France. And actually, they have a very good relationship to music in their films, and I think always treat it with the sort of respect that it deserves. But this film is so fantastic because it actually shows a sort of, you know, the idea that a hoodlum, I mean, he's a bad guy, you know, and what he wants to be is a concert pianist. And I think the fact that there are no edges around aspiration, and there should be none. And what I like about the film is that actually the music does help him find himself, find his place in the world, and ultimately, we rather suspect, find love. But it doesn't have the happy ending that he becomes a concert pianist. The other job that it does is it shows the incredible discipline of musicians and the incredible care and the amount of time and the amount of effort that goes into making something. And you rarely see behind the scenes of what it takes to make something and what it takes to be excellent. And I think it's very intriguing and paradoxical that in this film you have the hoodlum who shows us what it is to be a concert pianist and what incredible determination that takes.
Staccata in E minor, played by Caroline Durie, on the soundtrack to the 2005 film The Beat That My Heart Skipped. So, Beban, you've had this extraordinary career, and it's continued to take rather surprising turns. Do you know where you want to go next with it? I mean, and particularly in terms of subjects that you have perhaps always wanted to tackle?
No, I don't. And I think that one of the things about getting a bit older is that you actually relax into realising you don't know where you're going. And that's fine. I often speak to young people. I go out of my way to spend time with young people. And I often find myself saying, I might have had a very different career if I had just done one thing and done it again and again and again and polished the stone, as it were. Just Hollywood movies, just independent movies, just television, just documentaries. But you know what? I wouldn't trade my life for anything. And I think that the privilege of the journey that I've taken is that I've been in so many places and had so many experiences, and that I have never left the real world. The real world always imposes on me in some way, and that actually sort of designs the next step for me. And I think that if I can go on until I'm a grand old lady, you know, just having new experiences, saying my piece, helping give voice to those who are not, and in particular this thing about respecting and loving and looking after young people at the beginning of their journeys, then I'm a happy woman.
Well, thank you for sharing part of your journey, certainly the musical one, with us.
Thank you.
Private Passions was presented by Michael Barclay and produced by Jane Greenwood. It's a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3, and you'll find details of all of Beban Kidron's music choices on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. You can also listen again to the programme or download it from there. bbc.co.uk/radio3. Next week, from film to theatre, Michael's guest is the artistic director of the Royal Shakespeare Company, Greg Doran. That's next Sunday at 12 noon.
The surreal. The thought-provoking.
Why should we constantly judge everything by the market value that it creates?
The fantastical. The heartbreaking.
That win really pales into insignificance as to what I lost, which was probably around 30 grand.
Celebrating 20 years of the innovative Radio 3 programme Between the Ears, a specially created radio symphony broadcast in four imaginative movements over the four Saturdays of October. Shadowplay begins with an exploration of the notion of value. Part of a short season of programmes celebrating Between the Ears at 20. Shadowplay. Saturday night at 10 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
Hello, I'm John Shea, and welcome to this Sunday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3, which now has a new look from today. We have a lunchtime concert for you in a couple of minutes today. It's a piano recital given by Benjamin Grosvenor. Then our one weekly edition of the Early Music Show is at 2 o'clock on Sundays from now on. At 3, we have choral evensong. The choir is presented by Mary King at 4 o'clock. And our weekly selection of words and music can now be heard on Sundays at 5:30. It's now just after 1 o'clock. Time for the latest BBC News, read by David Cornett.
The Chancellor, George Osborne, has defended the government's decision to bring forward the second phase of the Help to Buy scheme from next year to next week. The arrangement will allow some people with small deposits to obtain mortgages of up to 95% of the value of a home. Mr Osborne has dismissed claims that it'll cause a housing bubble. 40 students are feared dead after suspected Islamist gunmen struck an agricultural college in northeastern Nigeria. The students were shot as they slept in their dormitory. The Boko Haram group is thought to be responsible. The government in Kenya has rejected reports that warnings of possible attacks by the Islamist group Al-Shabaab may have been ignored. At least 67 people died in an assault by the group on a Nairobi shopping complex last week. More than 30 people have been killed in two bomb attacks at a market in the Pakistani city of Peshawar. At least 70 were injured. In Greece, a sixth MP from the neo-Nazi Golden Dawn party has been arrested after handing himself in to police in Athens. Christos Pappas is the party's second in command. A warrant had been issued for his arrest. Italy's president is deciding whether to call fresh elections after the collapse of the country's coalition government. Giorgio Napolitano could try to encourage the formation of a new coalition instead, and is meeting politicians to discuss the crisis. A senior police officer has called for the decriminalisation of Class A drugs, such as heroin and cocaine. Writing in a Sunday newspaper, the Chief Constable of Durham, Mike Barton, said drug addicts should be treated rather than prosecuted. The Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, has appealed to Britain's top IT experts to become military reservists to protect the UK's computer networks from cyber attack. The Joint Cyber Reserve Unit will work alongside regular forces to protect critical computer networks and safeguard vital data. And the weather, cloudy across south and southwestern parts with rain or showers, some of them heavy with a risk of thunder, but diminishing as the day progresses. Elsewhere, it'll be a fine, dry but breezy day with sunny periods. BBC News and Weather at 3 minutes past one.
David Cornett, thank you very much. Well, more about the new look to Radio 3 Sundays as we go through the afternoon. As I mentioned, the early music show is now at 2 o'clock on Sundays. And in an hour's time, Catherine Bott will be here to look at an unfamiliar side of a familiar composer, the vocal and choral music of Domenico Scarlatti. That's in the early music show at 2. Before that, today's Radio 3 lunchtime concert. And from this week onwards, Sunday lunchtimes are when you'll be able to hear selected concert from recent years, which we think deserve another hearing. Today, a recital given at LSO St Luke's in October 2010 by the pianist Benjamin Grosvenor. He was then aged just 18 and about to start his 2 years as a Radio 3 New Generation artist. It's an all Chopin programme, beginning with the composer's first scherzo in B minor. His London publisher gave it the colourful French title of Le Banquet Infernal, the Infernal Banquet, and the piece certainly begins and ends demonically. In between, though, Chopin offers us some major key contrast when he quotes a Polish Christmas carol.